you.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Oh, don't be sniffy about
it. I'm not being sniffy.
I think you are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
by being morally uncompromising, he's inadvertently compromising his morals.
I actually thought about running out the door.
Feel free to take that on a bit. Accents do transform you.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
Peter Piper picked a pepper.
All right, Kurt, go ahead.
A peck of pickled peppers Peter Piper picked. Hello, sir. This is Kurt Anderson. How are you?
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well.
You're in New York City?
I am in New York City, where you were born, weren't you? Weren't you born here?
Yes. Yes, I was.
And I've got Danish great-grandparents.
Yeah, from your name, I thought you might.
Yeah. No, and when I go there, they and I give my credit card to people, they start speaking to me in Danish as though I might speak it.
Do you understand any of it?
Zero. I very much like this movie you made.
Well, thank you.
Like the rest of humankind, I saw Viggo Mortensen play Aragorn in Lord of the Rings movies. But it was his performances in a couple of different David Cronenberg films that really made me a Viggo Mortensen fan, especially when he played this Russian mobster, Nikolai, in Cronenberg's movie Eastern Promises.
Anger is very dangerous. Makes people do stupid things. Please, forget any of this ever happened. You're in very wrong place, Anna Ivanovna. You belong in there, with nice people. People like me.
Mortensen does accents well, maybe because his life has been kind of a road movie. He grew up in Argentina and upstate New York. He has lived in Denmark and Idaho and now in Spain. Professionally, he's also many things. In addition to being an actor, he is a musician, a photographer, a poet. He has his own publishing house, and on his publishing house website, he extensively quotes the leftist icon Noam Chomsky, all of which makes him perfect for his latest role, kind of typecast in Captain Fantastic. He plays this Noam Chomsky-loving renegade who is raising his six children in the woods off the grid in the Pacific Northwest. His character's wife is hospitalized, which has left him alone with his brood in the forest.
Why does Mommy have to be gone so long?
She hasn't been gone very long.
Actually, it's been 3 months, 2 weeks, 6 days, and 11 hours.
Mom is very ill.
Don't talk to us like we're your inferiors.
Bo is right. Mom needs to be in the hospital right now.
But you said hospitals are only a great place to go if you're a healthy person and you want to die.
You said Americans are undereducated and overmedicated.
You said the AMA are avaricious whores only tooling to spread their fat legs for Big Pharma.
All of those things are true, but Mom does not have enough of the neurotransmitter serotonin to conduct electrical signals in her brain.
Exactly when is Mom coming back?
That's what I'm going to go find out.
One of the things I loved about it is that even though, okay, this guy, your character, is the hero and the children have been taught well by him to be these Noam Chomsky-worshipping lefty children, that whole thing is also made fun of. I mean, it does both, you know? You take them seriously and regard them as earnest, right-thinking, perhaps more extreme than most of us people, but there is fun poked at them as well, which is a great trick.
Yeah. I mean, the movie does a rare thing. It has clearly delineated characters, very original characters, and you realize at a certain point, well, these are not the heroes. There are no heroes in this movie, and there are no villains, really.
Prepare for roles in more than is required. And with this one, you actually went out to the woods where you shot it and lived there before the thing even started shooting?
Yeah, I was fortunate. I was able to go there because we were going to shoot that first. And so I went out, you know, way early when they found the place and they started creating this clearing. And with the director and the production designer, we talked a lot about, well, how do we make this as believable as possible. Uh-huh. You know, that they're self-sustaining, that hygiene is taken care of. How do they feed themselves? How does it really work? We wanted it to be brutally real, completely credible, so that it would contrast in a credible way and hence funnier in a way at times and more striking with what you see once they leave the forest. So I got to go there and help. You know, I planted the garden. I brought starter plants because we said, well, it's this time of year. This is how big it would be. And in such a clearing, this is how much sun gets there. You have to have raised beds, et cetera. And then, you know, Matt, the director, Matt Ross, was saying, well, we need some little solar panel. We need – where do they wash? How do they do that?
Yeah. You mentioned Matt. Is Matt Ross the writer and director? And I saw I saw the movie and I saw, Matt Ross. Don't know who that guy is. Then yesterday, as I was doing my research, as it happens after watching the finale of Silicon Valley.
Billionaires are people too.
I saw it's the guy who plays the villain on Silicon Valley, who plays Gavin Belson.
Do you know who else vilified a tiny minority of financiers and progressive thinkers called the Jews?
Wait a minute. Did you just compare the treatment of billionaires in America today to the plight of the Jews in Nazi Germany?
Absolutely. One could argue that billionaires are actually treated worse. And we didn't even do anything wrong.
And it couldn't be more different. I mean, he's a really fine actor.
Astonishing.
He is very gentle, super intelligent, a good person.
As opposed to the character, the opposite.
And he's played in that and other jobs he's had. He's played these really weaselly kind of guys and sometimes outright bad guys. But he does it so well. And it's so much contrast with who he is.
And he has directed one very little scene feature before this. So this is his big, essentially, directorial debut. Even though there's a kind of extremism to his idealism and how he's decided to raise his children and live more off the grid than any of us, most of us can imagine, he reminded me, I mean, his straightforwardness with his children reminded me actually of my parents. And just like which astounded many of my friends in how frank they were, you know? Even though, you know, we lived in a house and my father was a lawyer. But were you raised like that, or did you raise your son that way?
In some ways, I raised my son that way. I certainly wasn't. I was a product of a fairly conventional model, 1950s model. Father, you don't see him that often. He's at work. He gets in late. He may or may not tuck you in. On weekdays, weekends, you might see him a little bit, might do some things. I do have good memories of doing things with him, of being, you know, taken with my brothers to go camping, fishing, learning to hunt at an early age, probably too early. But if there is, I mean, I was like four.
Oh, that's a little young.
I shot my first duck when I was 4 years old,
really?
Sitting in his lap with him holding the butt of the shotgun against his shoulder and me aiming and him being shocked that I actually hit it.
And that's what's great about this character is that he's a hard-ass, old-school, like, guy in supervising them very, very closely. And as he,
it's a rigorous training. They go through intellectual, training. Physical.
And yet he's not a right-wing survivalist. He's this commie.
But what's great, and you touched on this earlier when you were saying that at some point you realize, oh, it's not, this model isn't entirely condoned. It's not entirely condemned either.
Right.
I think on the plus side, the guy I played, Ben, the father of these six kids, wildly intelligent and, ferocious wolf pack of kids, I guess. One thing's unquestionable. He loves them and he's present and he is not the kind of dad that just says no because I said so.
Right.
He's the kind of dad that says perhaps not and let me explain why. And if you have a counter argument, I'd love to hear it.
Right.
It takes being truly present and it involves making mistakes because you may not always be right
or and he
on
does.
The right track.
And he does.
Yeah, and you see this in the story in a beautiful way. And then there's that test. You know, you're watching as an audience and you're wondering, okay, is he going to realize that at some point? Because we've already realized it, that he's on the wrong track and he's too extreme in some ways. And the very rigidity that he is so against in society and in any family model, he's actually engaging in it by being morally uncompromising. He is
exactly.
In a way. This, my son put it this way when he saw the movie. He said, by being morally uncompromising, he's inadvertently compromising his morals. And I thought that was a very astute observation.
Yes.
By my son.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's not all perfect by any means.
Yeah. You became famous really not until your 40s. I mean, you'd had this acting career and I'd seen you and I was aware of you, but you became famous with Lord of the Rings, the three Lord of the Rings movies.
You're outnumbered, Aragorn. You need more men.
There are none.
There are those who dwell in the mountain.
Murderers. Traitors. You would call upon them to fight. They believe in nothing. They answer to no one.
They will answer to the King of Gondor.
Are you grateful for that and what it's permitted you to do since?
Yeah, I mean, Lord of the Rings was a incredibly ambitious project, which was successful beyond anybody's imagination.
Right.
You know, when we were shooting it, you're hoping that people are going to like it, but we had no idea it would be such a phenomenon. It obviously gave us many more options. And I mean,
yep.
It just helped me have more options to do what I'd always been doing, which is look for interesting stories without any thought to what the budget is or nationalities.
Right.
Just
right.
I like stories that challenge me, that I'm going to learn something that I think will stand the test of time as being at least a great, you know, ideas, unique ideas for storytelling. But as far as The Lord of the Rings, yeah, it gave me the chance to work with Cronenberg.
Right.
Probably indirectly, it has something to do with the fact that Matt Ross could say, well, I want Viggo to play this guy, you know, in Captain Fantastic.
He's kind of bankable, right?
And the producer said, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And does, I presume, you made, if not $1 jillion, enough money that you can then pick and choose and say, nah, that's a piece of crap. I don't want to do that.
Well, I made, you know, money on Lord of the Rings, but I mean, I wasn't a known factor before
right.
that. So it wasn't like they had to offer me a ton of money to do it.
Right.
But the movie has done so well that, you know, we've gotten residuals and
yeah.
I've done very well. It's helped me with the money I made in Lord of the Rings. I could
right.
start Percival Press in 2002, the
right.
publishing company I have. I could do other things. I could help people, give money away. And I could also do, as I've done in the past 7 years, many movies where I didn't get paid anything or
really?
Very little. Yeah, sure. I mean,
huh.
I mean, movies like How Ha.
The Argentine movie you started in last year. Beautiful movie.
Well, in fact, How Ha, because I was a producer on it and one of the people that put some money into it. I mean, I lost money on that movie.
Which is of course, the not the standard thing. The standard thing would, oh, look at what I did. Now I can do Bourne Identities and James Bond films
mm-hmm.
and Captain Fantastic as a comic book movie, you know?
Well, I don't know. It comes down to how much money do you need? It's like, you know, you become famous and then you start selling watches and perfumes and cars.
You should do that.
And people do that
yeah.
and it's like, great. I don't know. I guess you could do that and give all that money to charity. Who
yeah.
knows? It's,
yeah.
Everybody can do whatever they want.
I'm Jen Aniston and I'm here to talk to you about Smartwater.
Dolce & Gabbana, the one.
Easy, breezy, beautiful, cover girl.
I've been driving a Lincoln since long before anybody paid me to drive one.
I personally, I look at that stuff, and first of all, when I see people basically being models, when I'm looking at an actor doing that, and they may have their great reasons for doing it, and that's fine. I'm not criticizing it. Just as an audience member, for me, no matter how good a job they do in a movie, I can't completely erase the image of them
yep.
selling a watch or
yep.
a perfume or a dress or a car from my mind. It's a more of a leap of faith.
Yep.
They really, really have to hit it out of the park for me to forget that.
Yeah.
So that's just as an audience member. I mean, you know, everybody's
yeah.
different in
yeah.
how they look at movies.
Yeah.
That's how I look at them. And the other thing is, I just say, well, how much money do you need? You know,
right.
I mean, life is short.
Yeah.
Make things that you're going to be proud of 10, 20 years
yep.
down the line.
So as a Dane as well as an American and somebody who lives in Spain, mm-hmm. how does the spectacle of imminent European disintegration strike you?
Well, I mean, it's been a long time coming. I can remember back when the prime minister was Edward Heath, and when they first joined, I guess it was around 72 or whenever it was, the common market in, you know, Great Britain, there was always misgivings, like there were in Denmark and other places about it. But, you know, so some countries like Denmark, like England, you know, kept their own currency. And, you know, Great Britain has always put conditions on their membership. Right. And they've done, frankly, in my opinion, the government anyway, has done a lot of whining about it. And, you know, I understand.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, you want to go, go. I liken it, and so I thought about it in terms of the movie in a way. Choosing to isolate yourself because you want to perfect your own unique way of being, which is one of the arguments that don't necessarily have anything to do with unfounded fear of immigration of the other or, you know, whatever, you know, economic
fears. We want our perfect little world,
Yeah, we want to have our uniqueness, and we want to foster it, and we don't want to lose it. We don't want to be beholden to anyone. That's not unlike what the Cash family does in Captain Fantastic, living off the grid. But one of the dangers of that glorious isolation and working on your own uniqueness is that you're closing yourself off to contact with others. And you can't learn, you know, kids, as we see in the movie, can't learn how to interact with others.
Right.
Just from books.
Yep.
You know, you have to go out and practice getting along or not getting along with people and negotiating how you interact with people. Yeah. That's only can come from experience.
Well, Captain Fantastic is a guide to life. It's everything. It's Brexit. It's parenting.
There you go.
Viggo Mortensen, this has been a delight. Thank you very, very much.
I love this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It's been great talking with you.
Captain Fantastic is in theaters now. And by the way, this is some of Viggo's music off his brand new album. It's a track called Summer's Here. Deanne Arbus put people from the margins at the center of her photograph.
I think there are things that nobody would see unless I photograph them.
And she took pictures that we just cannot unsee. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
I remember as a kid seeing Deanne Arbus's photographs for the first time when I was maybe 12 or 13 or 14 and just being absolutely riveted. I could not look away. Who were these people in these mysterious, fascinating black and white photographs? Not just the giants and the nudists and the bona fide weirdos, but people that she captured in ways that made me want to see around them, see the rest of their world. They were extraordinary, and they were really part of what made me want to move to New York City and probably to chronicle the world. Today, 45 years after she took her own life, Deanne Arbus's work is still riveting and still provocative. There's a new show of some of her early work that just opened at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And my WNYC colleague Sarah Fischko took a look at those photos and at the life of the woman who made them.
The classic Arbus photographs are like magnets. You're drawn into them, and they look right back at you through the eyes of their subjects, midgets, giants, clowns, twins, nudists. Arbus had spent years as a stylist for the fashion photography studio run by her husband, Alan Arbus. But she left all that behind in the late 50s when she declared herself an artist, with a very particular focus on people others might have turned away from. She wanted to show them to the world.
They are really very telling and empathetic pictures.
Vicki Goldberg, photography critic and historian, says some other photographers of the time had consciously avoided involvement or even contact with their subjects. Arbus was the opposite. There was nothing removed or distant about it.
It isn't as if she just did this passing by like a street photographer. She did this with the complete trust and acquiescence of all of her subjects, and it was startling to people that it was so open and so telling, so compelling.
Why are the pictures so arresting?
Well, first of all, the compositions are extremely classical. She centers her subject, and it's almost the classical studio portraiture, even if she's outdoors.
But the subjects are not classical at all.
And she has made them as important as the celebrity is, as the president is, whatever it is. She has photographed them with such an intensity that it radiates out of the pictures. And the fact that she could do this kind of rebellious photography within this classical framework, that had not been done.
The current exhibition shows some never-before-seen photos from her early years, just as she was stepping out to become her creative self. Seeing the show recently, pondering Arbus's shift from fashion work over to the other side in the 1950s and 60s, I couldn't help thinking about the film Blow Up, released in 1966.
Good, that's great. Yes, that's great. That's good, that's good. Yes, go on, that again.
It was the first English-language film of the star Italian director Michelangelo Antonioni.
Okay, right.
The story of a fashion photographer played by the English actor David Hemmings.
Come on, work.
His character, Thomas, does well running fashion shoots with glamorous, available young models, any one of whom he might or might not take to bed. And he dabbles in some more serious work.
I've gone off London this week.
But he's restless and almost mechanical.
Doesn't do anything for me.
Until his camera captures a complicated real-life scene being played out by a couple in the park, possibly even a murder somewhere behind the trees.
Give me those pictures. You can't photograph people like that.
Suddenly, the photographer is deeply engaged in discovering anything he can about the mysterious, dangerous images he's stumbled on. Blow Up has long, virtually silent sequences with our hero searching for the images in the shots in question, blowing up details, looking, blowing them up larger, looking again. Reviewing the film when it opened in 66, the then New York Times film critic Bosley Crowther said the film had something real to say about the matter of personal involvement and emotional commitment in a jazzed-up, media-hooked-in world so cluttered with synthetic stimulations that natural feelings are overwhelmed. And, oddly, he was right. While you could say this was a film about photographs and what they really are, and whether they really tell the truth and so on, the question of personal and emotional involvement in the work seems certainly as much the point, if not more. Obsession is the key. And that was the thing with Arbus, too, to let the obsession rule. The Arbus story, real rather than fictional, of course, is widely known, from a cloistered childhood of wealth and privilege to her suicide at age 48. But the work tells the real story. Even the feature film Fur, released 10 years ago and based very loosely on Patricia Bosworth's biography of Arbus, avoids actual biography by trying to untangle the impulses and emotions behind the photographer's fascination for what she called freaks.
I'd like to take a portrait of you and your wife.
That's Nicole Kidman as Deanne. The film is billed as an imaginary portrait.
I don't have a wife.
Well, then I would like to take a portrait of you, just you.
But you can also hear Arbus's own voice, speaking with her characteristic directness in an interview with Studs Terkel on WFMT, the exact date unknown, to the question of art and commerce.
I can't believe that money is any sort of proper reward for art. Sort of. I mean, art seems to me like just something you do because, you know, because it makes you feel good to do it, or because you, you know, it seems to excite you, or you learn something by it, or... Of course, I don't even feel that it's terribly useful. I think I maybe do it because I think there are things that nobody would see unless I photograph them.
Arbus's attraction for the underside, the darker side of humanity, takes us back once again to the post-World War II moment, when America experienced a sharp division of sensibilities. There were picket fences, suburban lawns, TV sitcoms, but there was also a whole movement of creative types in the other direction, towards cities, most notably New York, where they could experiment with art, jazz, fashion, comedy, theater, politics. Deanne Arbus even made her way in 1960 to W. Eugene Smith's Jazz Loft at 821 6th Avenue, a dark and urban spot. There's a David Heath photograph documenting her visit one day, and that's only the visit we know about. And Arbus went so far as to use military imagery to describe her journey toward the fringe characters that obsessed her. She said, "I'm creeping forward on my belly like they do in war movies."
Well, yes, because she's getting closer and closer, and she's getting to a point where something perhaps explosive is happening. And she really pulls that off.
Deanne Arbus created something no selfie can provide, a document of a complex relationship between artist and subject, resulting in something deeply personal and also curiously universal. Essential viewing.
Thanks to Sarah Fischko for that story, which first ran as part of her series, The Fischko Files, which are great essays about all kinds of art and culture she produces for WNYC. The new Deanne Arbus show, which is at the Met Museum's Breuer Branch, runs through the end of November. A lot of young men in the 1960s fantasized that they might become that swinging photographer of nude models from the movie Blow Up. Neil Selkirk was one of those guys. In 1966, the year Blow Up came out, he was a 19-year-old art student in England.
Photographers in London had convertible Bentleys, and they had models and rolls of colored seamless paper, and it was all terribly exciting and probably a way to meet girls.
And in fact, he was well on his way. At 20, he got hired as an assistant to Richard Avedon.
Avedon was doing advertising during the day, but in the evenings, we were doing editorial shoots. And one of them was to photograph John Huston's wife, daughter Angelica, and his son at their home. We set it up in this big living room, started looking around, and at one end of the room, there was a photograph. Three fat, naked people sitting on the grass with the back end of an old American car sticking into the side of the picture. A man in the center, heavy-set, middle-aged man with glasses on. And to the left of him is presumably his wife, a woman equally heavy-set, just sort of plopped like a dollop on the grass. And to the right, presumably their daughter, and they're just looking at the camera. I just thought it was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen in my life. I could not conceive as to why these people, who were physically quite profoundly unattractive, could be so completely comfortable with themselves in that condition. I was terrified. I was actually terrified. I actually thought about running out the door into the street and never coming back. It took me a long time to get a visa to come to the United States, but the studio got me a visa, and I started working there for Hiro, a Japanese photographer who shared the same space as Avedon. And I actually lived in Hiro's apartment in the Dakota. And propped against the wall by his library is the same photograph again. And I said, "I saw that picture in London, in John Huston's house." And he said, "It's by a photographer called Deanne Arbus. You'll probably meet her." The first time she came into the studio, she was short. She was wearing jeans. And she just started to talk and ask questions. It was incredibly seductive. Here was somebody who was utterly fascinated by people people gave themselves to Deanne. And so very much what she tended to photograph was their comfort with the fact that she was photographing them. Nobody felt exploited. So then in the winter of 1970-71, I took her master class that she held at Westbeth in the West Village where she lived. And I realized that the photographer that I had been when I arrived in the United States no longer existed at all. I was completely incapable of embellishing anything. I was solely absorbed with the photograph essentially as a document of some kind. I left Heroes in the spring and went back to Europe. I was working for a New York photographer, a German called Chris von Wangenheim, and out of the blue, in the studio we were working in Paris, Avedon is suddenly there. And he says hello to me, and then he and Chris went into a huddle. And then Avedon leaves, and Chris comes over to me and took me aside and told me that Deanne had killed herself. And I sort of didn't know what to do with myself, but very shortly wrote to New York and said, look, I'm going to be back in November, and if there's going to be a show or there's going to be anything, I would very much like to be involved. By the following winter, I was completely immersed, researching her negatives. I had to look at every photograph she'd ever taken and try and find the negatives for each photograph. And then, for the rest of the year, I spent every day printing them, obsessively trying to duplicate her own prints, which is an extraordinary process because it means you're studying absolutely every inch of every photograph in every way. And there was never any intention that it was going to be a lifelong commitment, but it turned out that I was the only person who ever printed her stuff after that. It's completely bizarre and ironic that the one work of art which completely independently of anything that I knew affected me so strongly that I wound up being so intimately involved with it. It's the only actual print she made that I own. And it insists that you dispassionately observe that that is enough. Things have moved on. These people may well be dead by now. And yet, the picture is still there, relentlessly reassuring me that I should never be sure about anything.
That's the photographer Neil Selkirk talking about a Deanne Arbus photo. It's a famous one called A Family One Evening in a Nudist Camp, Pennsylvania, 1965. As it happens, I've met Neil Selkirk exactly 30 years ago this month when he was shooting the first cover of Spy, a new magazine I was helping create at the time. And I was delighted to discover that Neil is a listener to this show and suggested this piece. Some of our best stories come from listeners. You guys have inspired what we call aha moments, a lot of them, like that one you just heard, as well as episodes we've done in our American Icon series.
Well, I hope you don't mind if I take a taxi. I'd like to stay away from all three of you for a while.
That was Dallas, of course. And now we are looking for your guilty pleasures, which may or may not involve soap operas set in Dallas. You know, that record or book or movie that all the smart and tasteful and cool people despise, but that you just love.
My guiltiest pleasure is probably Lana Del Rey.
I got my red dress on tonight, dancing in the dark in the pale moonlight.
It's such a guilty pleasure because I grew up, you know, a hip-hop head. I grew up on, like, Tupac and Biggie and Wu-Tang, you know what I mean? I love all that. But something about the Lana Del Rey, it's very striking. I think that's actually influence on hip-hop, because if you listen to the choruses of a lot of hip-hop songs, you'll hear music like that, like random one-off kind of girls singing maybe some dark melody, and that's what they are without the rapping. And everybody knows the chorus is the best part of the song.
So what is your great guilty pleasure? And why do you love it so much, even though you're not supposed to love it? Record a voice memo on your phone and send it to studio360 at wnyc.org. And we might put your story on the air. Still ahead?
Learning an accent is really like learning a dance for your mouth.
Uh-oh. So can my tongue be taught to do the waltz? That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Cheerio. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
That's it. Very good.
I've kind of always wanted to do that on the radio, stand more sophisticated and snooty and English than I am. There are these days a ton of British actors masquerading on television and in the movies as Americans. I think of Damian Lewis in Homeland and Hugh Laurie on House and several members of the cast of The Wire. So I wanted to find out if I could possibly do the reverse, to learn how to sound like Laurence Olivier.
Have a look at the Times. There's a thrilling article on what's the matter with English cricket.
Or one of the James Bonds.
Oh, by the way, we haven't been properly introduced, Melina.
The actress gave a class on Kraft.
The actress. Is it actress or is it more like actress than actress?
It's actress. Actress.
Okay. The actress gave a class on Kraft.
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 That's it, exactly.
The actress gave a class on Kraft.
Very good. That's it, exactly. Good.
And I think they want you just to say, I am Amanda Quaid.
Sure. Oh. Hi, I'm Amanda Quaid, and I work in speech, accents, dialects with actors from around the world, Americans learning foreign accents, and also international actors trying to work on their American accents.
And so speaking of hegemony of show business, I guess you're probably part of the Quaid acting dynasty.
Yes.
In some fashion.
Yes, correct.
You're related to those guys.
Yes.
So you began as an actor and just decided, find out you had a knack for doing this?
I fell into it really by accident. My first job was when I was 18. I was playing Juliet and I didn't have any diction skills. So I sought somebody out to help me with that. And she was the first person to identify that I had a good ability to not only do a lot of things with speech, but also articulate how to do it. So she started sending me her students when I was still very young.
Wow. So you've done this for how long? Of some years?
10 years, yeah.
Wow. Have you had horror stories of like somebody just couldn't do it?
Sure. There are people. I mean, it really depends. People learn very differently, and some people have an ear for it. Some people really can't feel what's going on inside their mouth.
Do you have theories of like which kinds of people can do it well or not? Or is there a pattern, or just some people can and some people can't?
Sometimes people who are musically inclined tend to have a good ear for it and can do it well. Often dancers do because they have a really keen kinesthetic awareness.
Uh-huh.
So learning an accent is really like learning a dance for your mouth.
Uh-oh.
And it's sort of the muscles in the mouth work together the way your legs would move if you were doing a tap dance.
Hmm. Okay. Dancing is not something I do that well either. So, and we think of, say, in addition to being a great actor, Meryl Streep, wow, she does those acts. She really talks like Maggie Thatcher. Whoa, she really did the Polish accent. As a professional in this, does she seem like somebody who has an uncanny knack?
She's pretty incredible at accents and a transformation. And I'm sure if you go to those places and ask people on the street who are locals, everybody will be able to split hairs with it. But the main thing is that she does it enough to tell the story to the audience that she needs to tell the story to. And that's really the whole purpose.
Right.
We will stand on principle.
or we will not stand at all.
But Margaret, with all due respect, when one has been to war...
With all due respect, sir, I have done battle every single day of my life, and many men have underestimated me before. This lot seem bound to do the same, but they will rue the day.
So that's Meryl Streep, obviously, in Iron Lady. So down to the nitty-gritty module, what's she doing well or less well?
Sure. So she's doing a lot of sounds really, really very well. Stand. And then she has this nice at all, right? She has a nice liquid you and you. She's dropping her R in before. But really, the thing that makes this accent crackle is not the individual sounds, although she's nailing everything. It's really the relish and the particular vocal pattern that she's capturing. It's the relish of the ideas, the relish of language, and particularly the strong use of consonants. It's very interesting. When Americans get passionate, we tend to get louder.
Uh-huh.
And when Brits get passionate, often they will invest more energy in their consonant sounds.
That's interesting.
So there's more in the language, and she's really finding that.
Okay. Well, let's try to do whatever we can do. What kind of British accent shall I try to do?
We'll look at what's called a received pronunciation.
Right.
And we'll look at something that's a little bit relaxed. So it wouldn't be what you would use for Oscar Wilde, but you might use it on the street today if you were there.
And by received pronunciation, just how people on television and radio on the BBC speak.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. It is just coming up to 6:30. We're going to bring you all the latest news.
Yes, exactly. It would be a relaxed received pronunciation. Okay. Received meaning you'd be received into society if you could speak that way.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, it's not... Oh, I see. I thought it meant received like conventional wisdom. No. Oh, I see. So it's slightly posh, but not too posh.
That's right.
Interesting.
Well, received pronunciation is very posh, but we'll work on a little bit
of
a modification.
Oh, really? Okay.
The majesty and grandeur of the English language is the greatest possession we have. The noblest thoughts that ever flowed through the hearts of men are contained in its extraordinary, imaginative, and musical mixtures of sounds.
So just begin by taking a big yawn and opening up the back of the mouth. So when you do that, you get a bit of space all the way in the back. And just try to sigh through that sound, just haw.
Oh.
That's fantastic. And now, just let your jaw go a bit high so that the back teeth are almost touching, exactly. And then your tongue comes up about halfway in the mouth. So just lift your tongue up and just sigh through that shape for a moment.
Oh.
That's it. Very good. Now bring your focus to the corners of the mouth.
Yes.
And you can pull them back and you can also push them forward. So imagine they're just going to get a bit bossy. Right, exactly. And just make the sound, oh.
Oh.
Can't you hear the difference? Look, put your tongue forward until it squeezes on the top of your lower teeth. And then say...
Horse.
Good.
Awful. Caught. Remorse. Stock. Daughter.
Daughter. Very
good. Daughter.
Right.
It's interesting because it's some version of onomatopoeia. When you say it's bossy, it is... There is something... Like a cartoon of an Englishman.
In a way, yeah. And feel free to take that on a bit. Accents do transform you, and that's sort of what we're after here.
All right. Cast.
That's it.
Bath. Clasp. Enhance.
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 Very good.
Basket.
Basket. So we would say, I can't, but you can.
You can?
You can.
But they don't can?
That's
not,
right.
Uh-huh.
So it's not an across-the-board one. This is one a lot of actors miss.
Okay.
I promise you you'll say your vowels correctly before this day is out, or there'll be no lunch, no dinner, and no chocolates. A-E-I-O-U.
Oh.
Yeah, very
like a little bit of... Yeah.
That's right, that's it.
I smell something awful.
Exactly, exactly. It's a bit of a bad smell.
Much have I travelled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told, that deep-browed Homer ruled as his demean.
And for those who can't see you right now, it's interesting, your whole posture has changed, your body is getting into it, and you're sitting up a bit straighter, so all of...
I've got my hand on my scabbard!
Yes. So an accent can actually change not only your mouth, but your whole body, your whole sense of yourself.
Yeah, it's true. And how do you get from this, what we've done, to sort of having it be automatic and not not imagining you're after, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, or, you know, not just having it be automatic.
Sure. Well, an actor would take these, let's say, these rules and then mark up their script with it so that they would be able to sort of see what they were supposed to say. And then, like a dancer, they would repeat it so many times that the muscle memory in the mouth starts to remember it for them. So the brain isn't communicating anymore. And then beyond that, I urge them to use it out in their life all the time so that they can start to feel a bit more in their own skin with it.
And so when you're training British actors to do the American accents, that's the idea is, okay, I've taught you a little bit, now go out and pretend to be an American?
Well, British actors can do the American accent technically very well. What they tend to struggle with is a feeling of being an imposter and a feeling of inauthenticity in the accent. So a lot of the work I do with them is a little more psychological.
Interesting.
And finding who they are in their American accent, which is a whole other question.
Well, and of course, since acting is by its nature a convincingly inauthentic thing, that's a sort of whole meta or an additional meta version of what acting is all about, I guess.
That's right. That's right.
And why is that not the case for Americans? I mean, they just don't feel they don't feel like frauds and posers as much?
I think it's different because the actors I work with are coming to American soil. So an American doing a British accent for other Americans is not going to feel the same pressure as a British person doing an American for Americans.
And so what kind of psychological, you know, encouragement, tricks, tutoring do you do for those people?
Well, I believe that any accent you work on should be something that brings out some part of you that can come out more in that accent than it can in your normal accent.
Right.
So I'll do it with you now. If I were to ask you to say this sentence, when I speak this way, I'm more...
When I speak this way, I feel more wealthy.
Wealthy, very good. A couple more words. What else?
I feel when I speak this way, I feel more... arch.
Good.
Contemptuous.
Superior.
Superior.
Yeah, great.
Yes.
So let's try this. My name is Kurt Anderson.
That's going to be hard. My name is Kurt Anderson.
And when I speak this way.
And when I speak this way.
I am wealthy, arch, and superior.
I am wealthy, arch, and superior.
Yeah, so that's.
Superior.
Superior, very good. So that's part of it, is finding a few words that are really attractive to the actor that they can feel, and a lot of, for many Brits, words that come up are like laid back, cool, global, confident.
Yeah.
So it's cool to see what the accent brings out in them as an individual.
Yeah.
Do you want to work with something a bit lighter?
Sure.
Okay, let's try that.
Oh, this is the Beastie Boys. That's funny. Okay. You wake up late for school, man. You don't want to go. You ask your mom, please, but she still says no. You missed two classes and no homework, but your teacher preaches class like you're some kind of jerk.
You've got to fight for your right to party.
You've got to fight for your right to party.
You got to fight!
My very sincere thanks to Amanda Quaid. And if you want to learn how to do a British accent, she taught me a bunch more exercises and tricks, and you can listen and learn them too at studio360.org. And that's about it for this week's show. Studio 360, or should I say Studio 360, is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Special thanks this week to Sharon Mashihi. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kestrel Woldemuth,
Joaquin Kotler,
Juliet Muller,
Emily Marinoff.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, thank God that's over. Now I can go to bed without dreading tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we go fossil hunting deep in the heart of Texas.
Here's the trick in finding treasure in the Sulphur River. You have to put everything out of your mind.
And pose a question you might not hear at Bible camp.
Why was God in such a rush to create the universe in 7 days? Did he have a deadline to meet?
Why Darwin still matters. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.